America is $36 trillion in debt. That's a number so big it's nearly impossible to comprehend, but it's still money owed to someone. People often point to China as the biggest lender, and sure enough, they hold about $750 billion worth of it. But here's the thing, China is also drowning in debt of its own. In fact, over $18 trillion worth and counting. So who's holding their debt? A lot of it sits with Chinese banks. But those same banks also own debt from the United States. And American banks, they're holding debt from China, and Europe, and just about everyone else. If that sounds confusing, it's because it is. The deeper you go, the more entangled it all becomes. Every country is borrowing, every country is lending, and somehow the world is now $300 trillion in debt, triple the size of the actual global economy. But if the world is in this much debt, then who is it all owed to? It's a really simple question, but one with a surprisingly complicated answer. It's not just a weird accounting trick, but a clue that something much deeper is happening under the surface. The answer reveals how the modern world isn't built on stability, it's built on motion, on a never-ending cycle of borrowing, lending, and reinvesting. This is the story of how global debt became the engine of the modern world, and what would happen if people really stopped lending. Debt might sound like a modern problem, just a big, scary number on a government spreadsheet. But in reality, it's one of the oldest ideas in human history. Long before banks, before coins or paper money, debt was simply a promise. Imagine lending your neighbor a bag of grain in the spring. When harvest came, they'd pay you back, maybe with a little extra as a thank you. No interest rates, no complicated contracts, just trust. Because for thousands of years, humans understood a simple concept. Sometimes you need something right away, but can only pay for it later. That's all debt really is at its core. Borrowing from tomorrow to solve a problem today. Over time, simple personal loans evolved into something much bigger. Kings wanted castles, empires needed ships and cannons, but no single lender could foot the bill. In the 1600s, England faced this exact same problem. King Charles II was preparing for war with the Dutch, but the treasury was empty, and the nobles refused to lend. So they tried something new. They sold pieces of debt to the public. In return for cash, citizens got a written promise of repayment with interest, a bond. It was simple, but it changed everything. States could now raise huge sums of money without raising taxes or draining their treasuries, and by the 20th century, bonds went global. World War I and II pushed countries to borrow at an unprecedented scale, not just to fight, but to rebuild. Then, in 1944, the Bretton Woods Agreement made the US dollar the centerpiece of the global financial system. Currencies were tied to the dollar. The dollar was tied to gold, but gold was limited, and economies had to grow. As the US ramped up spending, there wasn't enough gold to back the flood of dollars in circulation. So in 1971, President Nixon broke the link, ending the gold standard. From that point on, money became what we now call fiat currency, not backed by gold or anything physical, just by government decree. Governments could now create at will, and if that sounds like a recipe for endless borrowing, it was. From the 1980s onwards, global debt exploded. Countries discovered that borrowing wasn't just useful in wartime, it could fuel the economy's growth too. And so borrow they did, to build schools, repair roads, and even to carry the economy out of recession. Debt became the engine of progress for first and third world countries alike, and over time, it stopped being a last resort and became the norm. Today, debt is how things get built, how crises get managed, and how promises get kept. And the result? A global debt mountain that now tops $300 trillion, more than three times the value of everything the world makes in a year. To put that into perspective, a stack of $1 million bills would be 100 meters tall, and about the height of a 30-story building. $1 billion would reach 100 kilometers, high enough to touch the Earth's atmosphere, but 300 trillion is enough to go to the moon and back 50 times. That's the amount of debt that we're talking about. So, if every country is borrowing, who are they borrowing from? And if everyone owes money, who's getting paid? When we talk about the national debt, it's easy to picture some big, powerful, shadowy figure pulling the strings and holding all the money. But that's not how it works, because modern debt doesn't just move in straight lines like we're used to, it moves in circles. To better understand this concept, let's zoom in on the United States, the world's most indebted country. You may be wondering who can possibly lend them that much money, but here's the surprising part. Roughly 70% of the debt is actually owed to Americans themselves. So the US borrows from itself. Here's how it works. We know that governments borrow money by issuing bonds and promising to pay it back with interest, the exact same way that you would borrow money from a bank. So who is buying these government bonds? Well, most likely you. When you put money into the bank, it doesn't just sit there in a vault. Banks put the money to work, trying to grow it so they can pass some interest back to you, which they do by lending, investing, and of course, buying bonds. As of now, commercial banks in the US hold nearly $1.8 trillion worth of US Treasury bonds, triple the entire GDP of countries like Brazil or Canada. Bonds are an incredibly popular investment because they're one of the safest ways to earn interest on spare cash. Unlike the stock market, they don't bounce up and down every day. Of course, the interest rate can still be changed by the government to help manage the economy. And in the 1980s, yields jumped to over 15% as the government tried to bring down high inflation. And during the COVID recovery in 2020, they dropped below 1% to encourage more spending. But whenever you buy a bond, the rate is fixed until you get paid back fully. So whatever the government does afterwards isn't your problem. A 10-year US government bond today will pay you a steady 4.5% interest per year, which is pretty good considering the near zero risk. And that's a big part of why bonds and debt are so popular. So of course, it's not just banks who buy up the bonds. It's anyone sitting on a large pool of money. Pension funds, insurance companies, investment firms, they all do the same thing. Buy bonds and earn interest. In 2024, US pension funds invested a quarter of all their money into bonds. And for insurance company, this number was even higher. Over 60% of their assets were placed in bonds, using them as a reliable way to grow their funds while keeping risk low. This creates a kind of hidden network where people's savings become loan money for the government. So although it may sound weird that the US is borrowing from itself, it's actually just money flowing from parts of the country where it's sitting idle to parts where it's needed and being spent. When the government pays interest on its debt, that money flows right back into the hands of the lenders, giving them even more spare cash. And what do they do with it? They buy more bonds and earn more interest. This becomes a sort of self-reinforcing loop, where money constantly cycles through the same system by moving from lender to borrower, then back to lender, and then back to borrower, over and over. And the same loop exists between countries too. About 30% of US debt is held overseas, because just like American banks or pension funds, foreign governments and banks also put their spare cash into US bonds. And following the same logic, money flows in when we borrow, back out when we return, and repeats. Now, remember, it's not just the US doing this. Every country is borrowing, and every country is lending. The Japanese savings become loans for the Dutch. The Dutch savings become loans for the Brazilians. And the Brazilian savings, they end up flowing back into American bonds. The world's debt isn't just a pile of unpaid bills waiting to explode. It's more like an interconnected web of circular systems, where money flows in loops from savers to borrowers and back again. Governments borrow, investors lend, and the interest payments keep the cycle going. And while some of that money crosses borders, most of it never really leaves the system. It just changes form, hands, and keeps moving. So if the government keeps borrowing and spending it all, how do they pay back their debt in the future? Well, here's the thing, they simply just borrow more debt to pay back their old debt. And although that might sound reckless, which it kind of is, it's actually the foundation of how the global economy now works. So why does this system just keep going? Why doesn't the world just stop borrowing? Because now we're in a point where everything, from our economy to our politics, is built around debt. The uncomfortable truth is that debt fuels growth. When the government borrows and spends, money circulates into the economy. Businesses earn more, workers get paid, and so they spend more. It becomes a feedback loop that keeps the economy expanding so everyone can be better off. In China, 19% of all government spending comes from debt, meaning one in every 5 yuan they spend is actually borrowed. And this figure is even higher in the US, around 1 in 4 dollars. That's the same amount of money it spends on both education and welfare combined. If the government suddenly stops borrowing, it would have to spend less, and money stops flowing into the economy. Businesses earn less, workers lose their jobs, and so they stop spending. That very same loop that grows the economy is turned upside down, leaving everyone worse off. Take Greece, for example. When the 2008 financial crisis hit, investors panicked and suddenly stopped buying Greek bonds because they seemed so risky. Greece was left unable to borrow and quickly ran out of money to spend. One in four public workers were fired, wages fell by 30%, and over the next few years, their GDP shrank by a whopping 25%. Politicians know this, and so do the people. Everyone wants the government to keep on spending so the economy can keep on growing, and so no one wins elections promising austerity. Spending continues, and borrowing becomes inevitable. But it's not just about growth. Sometimes it's about survival. When an economic crisis hits, like COVID in 2020, people stop spending and the economy shuts down. The only way out of this is for the government to step in and cover that spending people are unwilling to do. In a crisis when people aren't paying their taxes, they have to borrow. In 2020, the US government borrowed an astonishing $3.8 trillion in a single year, nearly 20% of their entire economy. And so did China, Europe, and every other economy out there. It wasn't a choice, but a necessity. Now, remember, when you borrow money, it must be returned in the future. And if a government is already spending everything it collects just to keep the economy going, where does the money to repay old debt come from? The answer is simple. To pay back what they borrow again. And this debt just never leaves the system. In wealthier countries like Germany and Switzerland, this isn't seen as a major problem. Their bonds are considered safe, so they can keep on borrowing at low interest rates, making debt easier to cycle through. But for developing nations, it's a different story. Higher borrowing costs make each rollover more expensive, and over time, the debt starts to feed on itself. Countries like Sri Lanka and Pakistan have found themselves in a debt trap, where they are forced to just keep borrowing to meet the interest payments on past loans. So when people ask in America, why can't we just stop borrowing? The truth is that we can't. The same debt that weighs us down are actually the very pillars that the entire economy was built upon. And this raises an uncomfortable question. Can it really go on like this forever? Because no matter how smooth the cycle seems, there are risks building beneath the surface. Risks that the government avoids talking about and that no one really wants to face. As the government continues to borrow, the debt grows and so do the interest payments. Over time, a bigger and bigger slice of the budget goes back towards paying old loans, not funding new schools, hospitals, or infrastructure. Having a debt-to-GDP ratio near 100% is now seen as the normal, when a few decades back it would have been catastrophic. This isn't really a problem when borrowing is cheap and lenders are confident, but that all changes with risk. If investors stop wanting to lend, the cost of borrowing suddenly shoots up. One way governments try to handle this is by printing more money. This might sound like an easy fix, but it comes with a big downside. When more money enters the system, it reduces the value of each individual unit. And the result is inflation. Prices rise, savings shrink, and people start to feel poorer. In extreme cases, it can spiral out of control. In Venezuela in the late 2010s, the government printed so much money to cover its debts that the price of goods doubled every few weeks. A loaf of bread that used to cost 10 bolivars suddenly cost millions. The currency became almost worthless, and ordinary people saw their life savings vanish overnight. While most countries don't face such extreme cases, even moderate inflation can cause big problems by making their currency less valuable. The risks are even bigger for many developing countries, as they often borrow in foreign currencies like US dollars as a security, which means if their own currency weakens, paying back debt suddenly becomes more expensive in local terms. And as that burden grows, lenders may start to doubt a country's ability to repay, and it doesn't take long for the mood to shift. Suddenly, investors demand higher interest rates to compensate for the risk. And when governments can't borrow enough, how do they pay back their old debt? Do they cut spending, hike taxes, print more money? None of these options are easy, and they all come with severe consequences. And even if they do go through it, there's no guarantee that they will even make enough money. Eventually, if a country can't find the money and the bills come due at once, the country runs out of options. That's when they default. A default is when a country simply says, we can't pay. It's the sovereign equivalent of missing your mortgage, except it's not just your house at risk, but the entire economy. And worst of all, the government can't just borrow its way out, because nobody wants to lend to a defaulter. But when a system becomes fragile and dependent on debt, people start looking for something real. And that's exactly what we're seeing right now. Record sums are flowing into gold in 2025, and for good reason. Gold is up nearly 28% this year alone, while the dollar is down almost 9%, trading at a three-year low. Silver just hit a 13-year high, and mining stocks, the GDXJ index, is up nearly 45%, a staggering move. Even the world's biggest banks are now making bold calls. JP Morgan sees gold reaching $4,000 by mid-2026, and this is backed up by Goldman Sachs and Bank of America. Today's sponsor, Gold Mining Incorporated, ticker GLDG, trading on the New York Stock Exchange, is trading at approximately the same price it did in June 2018, when gold's price was less than half of what it was today. GLDG is trading at a near 5-year low, while gold is hitting new highs. Gold Mining owns one of the largest gold and copper resource stage mineral portfolios in the Americas. We're talking some dozen projects across 5 countries, located in pro-mining jurisdictions in Canada, USA, Brazil, Colombia, and Peru, with an estimated 12.4 million ounces of gold, equivalent in the measured and indicated category, and an additional 9.1 million ounces of gold, equivalent in the inferred category. Gold Mining Incorporate doesn't just own resource stage mineral properties, it also has a portfolio of publicly traded equities and cash. Their publicly traded equity holdings alone are worth more than $150 million based on the market closing prices of those securities on June 5th, 2025. This now surpasses the current market cap of the entire company, plus they hold $6.8 million in cash, an equivalent of the last reported quarter and financials on February 28th, 2025. Let that sink in for a second. Their portfolio of equities, without even talking about its cash and equivalents in its gold projects, is worth more than the entire market cap. As you can see in this graph, gold stocks have a tremendous gap to close compared with gold's spot price, which has soared. Gold reserves must be replenished. Size, quality, and location matter. And one of the biggest challenges facing the gold industry today is reserve replacement. Large mining companies need new discoveries or M&A activity to replace the ounces they're producing. And that's where companies like Gold Mining come into focus. They're led by a proven team. David Garofalo, former Goldcorp CEO, Amir Adnani, serial mining entrepreneur, and ex-Newmont executives. And the insiders own over 10 million shares, putting real skin in the game. Lastly, look at the key shareholders of Gold Mining Incorporate. Ruffer, BlackRock, Sprott, Morgan Stanley, GDXJ, ETF, UBS, and Goldman Sachs, just to name a few institutions that are all key shareholders. Management and insiders, as well as key shareholders, all have positions in this stock. It's currently trading at just 76 cents right now, as of June 12, 2025. If you're looking at companies with leverage to the gold price and a long-term development strategy, GLDG may be worth a closer look. Check out Gold Mining, ticker symbol GLDG, and visit goldmining.com.